Welcome to Bartcast 59. I'm Chad Myers.
And I am Elaine Enns.
It's Memorial Day 2022. 100 years ago, the world was recovering from an earlier pandemic, as we are today. 100 years ago, Russia was fighting a bloody war in Ukraine, one that displaced and disenfranchised many of Elaine's ancestors in Ukraine. So it's a good time to remember. And we have with us as our guest on today's podcast, Rose Marie Berger. Rose is senior editor at Sojourners Magazine, a veteran journalist and activist, someone deeply involved in the Catholic nonviolent movement around the world. And Rose, welcome to the Bartcast and to this podcast. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you, Ted, Elaine.
You really are literally 48 hours off the plane, and so all these stories are very much brimming in you. You just returned from Ukraine and Poland on a peacemaking delegation, but before we get into that, this was not your first peacemaking delegation. You've done these kinds of things in war zones before. Tell folks some of what you've done in the past.
Some of the places that I have gone before have been the West Bank and Israel in the mid-80s, and Northern Ireland, especially Belfast and Derry, and later on El Salvador and Colombia, and then probably the most significant time was in Bosnia and Kosovo during the genocidal wars there. And of course, I spent 35 years in inner city Washington, D.C., where there also were pretty critical conflicts.
So you, it was in part based on this experience that you were invited to participate in a new peacemaking effort in this awful, excruciating war that is happening now in Ukraine.
Yeah, and Rose, we are just so grateful for you to have been a part of this delegation. And can you go ahead and tell us who invited this delegation? What kind of groups were involved? How did the planning go? How did it all come together?
Yeah, thank you. There was a build up to the war early this year. A lot of the humanitarian aid agencies were giving signals that that Mr. Putin might be taking military action against Ukraine, but most politicians didn't think it would happen. That the cost to Putin would be too high. However, on February 21st, he announced that that he was going to recognize the independence of certain sections of Ukraine. And with that announcement, he would launch a special military action in order to, quote unquote, recover those sections of Ukraine that he would like to annex into Russia. On February 24th, he officially signed the documents for the special military action, and within hours there were missile strikes on Kyiv. And there were a group of us who were part of the Catholic Nonviolence Initiative who began talking together about how we could get a religious delegation of peacemakers into Ukraine, and what our purpose would be and how effective that could be. And we were looking for partners, particularly in the region, and sort of stumbled upon a Polish group that was also organizing a religious delegation, trying to get a delegation into Kyiv. And so we began partnering together, and our particular response was to the mayor of Kiev's call to have religious leaders, international religious leaders from around the world, come together and meet in Kiev and establish a prayer presence for peace there in that city. So two months later, May the 24th, we were able to bring a religious delegation into the city of Kiev.
And who were the different faith groups that were a part of that?
Yeah, that was part of the delight of this delegation. Is it came together very quickly on the one hand because we were waiting for dates from the Ukrainian government that they felt like would work for them. So we had people from the United Kingdom and from Italy, from the United States and from Poland. And then we had members, leading representatives of Islam. Two imams were with us. Bishop Joe Wells of the Anglican Church of England, and then a Jewish rabbi from Poland, as well as a number of other active lay leaders and other religious leaders representing a variety of versions of Christianity, particularly from one I wanted to mention is May Cannon. Reverend May Cannon was with us, who is from the Evangelical Covenant Church. Mm. So while we had several Catholics in our mix and Anglicans, it was nice to have a representative from the Evangelical community.
That's wonderful. Yeah. Earlier you spoke about a clash of cultural visions that is kind of the backdrop of this war between Ukraine and Russia. And so can you tell us what you mean by that?
As I mentioned earlier, the initiation of this delegation was Mayor Klitschko, the mayor of Kiev, in early March, put out a video on Twitter, really extending an invitation for the world's religious leaders to come to Kiev, to make Kiev a city of spirituality and peace. But what we learned there is that Kiev is known historically as a city of spirituality and peace, a city where different faiths live together, work together, celebrate together, and create a very robust and dynamic intercultural, interreligious culture. And because Kiev is on the sort of on the borderline between the East and the West, because it's historically been a trade route, it's just a very diversely culturally diverse city. And so I think really what the mayor was asking was for religious leaders to come to Kiev to help protect and maintain the strength of that diversity. And Ukraine is known as a place of you know, many, many cultures living together and wants to preserve that heritage. Part of what is under attack at this juncture is that Mr. Putin is really operating out of a worldview that is known there as Ruski Mir, which, you know, an equivalent might be Pax Romana or Pax Americana, except that in the case of Russia, it's really a cultural imperialism where there is a movement to displace anyone who is not ethnically Russian. Mm-hmm. And to move ethnic Russians into these places. So there really is a genocidal campaign to drive Ukrainians out of Ukraine and to move ethnic Russians into as much of Ukraine as they can succeed in taking. And that's the same process that Putin is taking in Crimea. And in many of the surrounding states.
So in the dominant media in North America, we get a lot about the geopolitical landscape of this conflict. And we hear that Putin is upset that Ukraine is looking west and afraid of alliances with NATO, and Biden is talking about strengthening Ukraine's Western orientation. But you're really telling us that a deeper underpinning here is the struggle not between a Western-oriented Ukraine, but its own unique multicultural history, and that is what is really under attack as well.
Yeah, I think that's right. There's a strong desire as part of this Ruski Mir ideology to have a very narrow and traditional and single ethnicity understanding of family life, of church life, of social life, to make it basically an ethnically pure white supremacist, we would say, culture, and which is absolutely antithetical to the history of Ukraine and the diversity of religions and cultures and people that Ukraine prides itself in, as and Ukraine really prides itself in being a place where many, many groups can come together and live together peaceably.
Hmm. Obviously, this is not part of the story that's getting out in the Western press, and we're so appreciative that you and your delegation have had this experience and this insight. We want to switch here and allow you to talk about some snapshots of your time. And in order to introduce one of them, I want to turn to Elaine. Many of you listeners know that Elaine has ancestral history in Ukraine. And in sending you off on this delegation a couple of weeks ago, Elaine, you handed a very special talisman to Rose. Tell us that story.
Well, you know, you're naming places like Crimea and Kyiv, and 12 years ago I was there. And Crimea is where my paternal grandmother, Ents, was from. So I spent time in Crimea, and I spent time going up the Dnieper River and ended our time in Kyiv. And during this trip, we went, Kortitsa is the first settlement of Mennonites in the 1780s in Ukraine. And there was a beautiful tree, and the Mennonites, that tree was there long before the Mennonites got there, but they called it the Alta Eiche, the ancient or the old oak. And they estimate it's over 800 years old, and I'm not sure if it is still standing. But while I was there, I collected a few acorns. There were a number of things I tried to bring back from Ukraine, and that was one, those three acorns. And so I was so grateful that you were making this trip, that I wanted to give my last acorn from the Alta Eiche to you. And I had some words around, you know, your desire to be planting peace, and maybe with this seed, this acorn, that could be a part of that. And then you did something with it. And I would love to hear that story.
Yeah, it was so delightful to have that acorn in my pocket and just be looking for where it would end up. Mm. And when we traveled to Irpin and through Bucha, where there have been really atrocious war crimes, and we traveled to the Caritas Center there, well, in two locations. In one location, we were visiting a Greek Orthodox church where the community of 30 people had lived in the basement for 2 weeks while the Russian and Ukrainian forces fought over their heads, just praying that this community in the basement would not be discovered for fear of what would happen to them if the Russian forces found them. But one story we heard there was that a missile had been aimed toward, was heading toward the church, this new beautiful Orthodox church that they had, they haven't quite finished building, and that it was actually the trees near the buildings that sort of diverted the missile. And so it hit the tops of the trees, and then it crashed into the edge of the priest's house rather than destroying the church. And so I just had that concept in my mind that the trees really protected the church. And then we went from there a few blocks away to the Caritas Center, which is a major site now for humanitarian aid and food distribution. And there, the Caritas Kiev offices had been there at this site. And their building early in the war was bombed, and several of their staff were killed. Mm. But it's on a property that, you know, maybe for us would be like a retreat center. It had several buildings and several outdoor sleeping areas and campfire areas and beautiful trees and park-like environment. Now it was filled with military tents that are filled with humanitarian aid. And it's a place where a lot of the elderly who couldn't leave the area have come to live. But in that park-like place, there too, the trees had been destroyed by shelling. They were really just sort of splintered. And then the ones that remained, many of them had been cut down and planed into planks. To sort of help with some of the reconstruction of some of the buildings. So it just seemed like when I saw those trees there and heard the stories of the trees, that this acorn that you had given me wanted to come home to that place. Mm-hmm. So I was delighted to be able to offer it to the woman who's really the community leader there. She was somebody, she's an elder, she had lost everything, and she was pouring all of her energy into the community, organizing to serve her community. And so I presented it to her. I told her the story of De Alta Aica and asked if we could plant it there. And she took it and she said, yes, we can plant it, but I will plant it and we will plant it as a community later. And we will give it a proper ceremony. And now I just said to her, this is from a very ancient oak, and I want you to plant it here so that it can grow to be as strong and resilient as the Ukrainian people that we have met on this trip. Mm-hmm. And she was very grateful, and she had tears in her eyes. I had tears in my eyes, but, you know, so hopefully the oak will get planted and watered.
Wow, that is beautiful. And you have, I'm sure, so many stories of the beautiful people, the powerful people that you met. Is there another story that you would want to share with us?
Yeah, I think there's two. One's maybe a little bit more general, but part of the reason for having a religious delegation is, one, because our faiths motivate us toward peace, so we need to take actions for peace. And that was part of this delegation. But the other piece of that is that in times of crisis, it's often the religious leaders and the religious communities who respond and who are doing a bulk of the work of addressing the crisis. And often those religious leaders are being asked to do things that they're not used to doing. You know, the most stressful thing in an archbishop's day is maybe that he's going to be late to a meeting. But now, you know, now the archbishop is driving 20 hours to get humanitarian aid, is listening to people who have been through, brutal abuse, they're comforting women who've lost their husbands and sons in the military. And so part of a religious delegation to religious leaders is to offer some care and comfort to them as they are trying to carry the suffering of their people. But also at the Caritas Center, we met a few very, very elderly women, particularly one whose name was Maya, and she was 92. And she, I don't know if she had been born or as a 1 or 2 year old, She had been in one of the Nazi death camps, and her entire family was killed. And so she was sort of lamenting and identifying that she, as a child, she was alone. And now at the end of her life, she was also alone. But that she had this community here with her at the Caritas Center that was really valuable to her. But these, you know, these women, and particularly Maya, so survived the Nazi death camps as children, fought against, even as young adults, fought against the ongoing Nazi and authoritarian movements, then survived the Soviet era.
Yeah.
And now in their early 90s are going through this terrible, terrible aggression and war and attack on civilian life. And Maya just said, you know, I've lived through these things. I've got the numbers on my arm. We suffered through the Soviet regime. And this last 2 months with Mr. Putin's aggression is worse than that. Yeah.
Oh, those incredible, mostly women, because the men that are able to fight have gone to do that. Mm. And these women, so grateful for them too, of holding down their community and being so strong. There's one more story that we want to get from you, and we just heard inklings of it, but it's a fabulous story of three rabbis.
So at one point, because of the way these trips often run, they're just sort of messy and chaotic and full of miraculous moments. And so at one point we were gathered at a restaurant for dinner and realized that we had not one Orthodox rabbi, not two Orthodox rabbis, but three Orthodox rabbis with us. And so Maurice Glassman, who's a member of parliament who was with us on the delegation, who's also a member of the Jewish community, said, well, when you have three Orthodox rabbis, you have to present the question. And this is a very formulaic, traditional way of engaging deep rabbinic teaching on any particular moment, that the student who Maurice was taking the role of the student presents a question to the rabbis and then they discuss. And so Maurice put this question to the rabbis, is Putin Pharaoh? Is Putin Pharaoh? And so in typical tradition, one of the rabbis said, I would push back on the question and say, I'm not sure that Pharaoh is an individual. Perhaps we should think about Pharaoh as a system. Mm-hmm. The other rabbi said, this isn't the question of Putin and the war is not a question of Pharaoh, this is a question of Gog and Magog. So this is an apocalyptic battle between the forces of good and evil. And the third rabbi said, you know, I'm less interested in whether Putin is Pharaoh and more interested in who are the people who are moving toward liberation. Mm. And so they're just in that short conversation, I think you got some of the depth of the issues and the traditions that are being wrestled out, right? Yeah, right now.
Yeah. And what incredible learning that you got to be a part of these conversations and meet these incredible people on your delegation, and then also obviously the people of Ukraine. And again, we are just so grateful for you to go and to do this work. But we do, we have one more question, and maybe you do, but what, you know, what is now the next steps? Like, what was the networking that happened and the connections that were made and the follow-up that is inevitable out of this?
So part of the reason that we went was to prove that it could be done. Because there had been some religious delegations just crossing over the border, but no interreligious international delegation had gone to Kyiv since the start of this war. And so we wanted to set a pattern to make it clear that it is possible to do these delegations. And then we modeled public prayer services that were covered by the press in the hopes that other cities or other delegations to Kyiv will take up a similar kind of public interreligious prayers for peace. So I think on the one part, that was our goal, was just to show that it could be done and establish a model. And we were very delighted that on the bus on the way back to Warsaw, we received an email from the mayor's office of Kyiv saying, here's the official letter with all the official stamps and the official signatures saying that the city of Kyiv will welcome these delegations, will put resources at the disposal of the organizers, and that they hope the next delegation would come in a month.
Wow.
So that was, you know, one piece that we hope will be successful, that there will be more delegations. The other piece was more just the establishing of contacts and relationships. And by the time the delegation returned to Warsaw, there were a few of us sitting around in the cafe before people were leaving for the airport. And one of our delegation got a phone call. It turned out it was from a Ukrainian government official who was trying to get 150 children and their mother or caregivers out of the violence in Kharkiv. And she had been promised by a British NGO that the British NGO would provide visas for the children, and the visas had not arrived. And so now this government official had 150 or 170 people sleeping on the floor of a warehouse at the border, trying to get these kids and their moms to someplace safe. And so one of our members on the delegation, as I said, was a member of parliament. And so he immediately started making calls and felt like he could successfully get the visas moving through. Now, I don't know the end of that story. We'll find out in the next few days how that story has ended. But that was just an example of the relationships already beginning to bear fruit.
These are the kinds of things that can really only happen when you're on the ground. And what a poignant week that you spent trying to see and hear the story on the ground and lend solidarity. One thing you told us was that over and over people were surprised. Ukrainians were surprised surprised that you all had come. What did that feel like for you, and what does that mean to you?
Well, on the one hand, you know, we're people of faith. We don't have any option but to try to stop injustice by going there, with our hands and our bodies. And so, if we can go, then we go. And I think what one person said, the wife of one rabbi, you know, she just burst into tears again when she saw us. She said, I can't believe you come. I can't believe you're actually here. You came all the way here. And I said to her, well, the mayor sent his invitation in early March, and now it's late May and we're just getting here. I'm sorry that we're late. And she said, no, you are not late. You have just arrived right on time. because I'm afraid that the world is already forgetting about Ukraine. Mm. And so there's such value in being there in person. Mm. And I just pray that the world will not forget about Ukraine. Ukraine, of course, is not the only war going on in our world. But that's not what we measure our compassion by. And the people of Ukraine need to know that the world is supporting them and caring for them. And quite frankly, when she says the world is forgetting, that she means that literally. Food aid has dropped from receiving, you know, 10 cargo trucks for a week down to 2. And so she's saying, what do we do, you know, at the end of summer? What do we do when it gets to be winter? So please don't forget us, was her plea.
How can people find out more about this delegation? Is there a contact? Who can they write? Maybe Care of Sojourners?
Yeah, I guess people can write to me at my address at Sojourners. I think that we'll be hopefully posting some things there and maybe running some things in the magazine. But you can go to www.sojo.net and look under the staff listing, and you'll find my name there, Rosemary Berger. And you can click on the link, and it'll send me an email. And I'd love to hear from people and hear your questions.
Mm. Well, at a time when the most Western countries can muster by way of solidarity is to send more weapons, we're so deeply grateful that you and your delegation came in the name of the great peacemaker. And thank you, Rose, for this work and this witness. And we're glad you're home safe.
Yes.
Thanks so much for being with us today on this Memorial Day. Let us remember all of those under the scourge of war and all of those trying to make peace.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Amen.